Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is Friday, July 12, 2024. It's a sunny and very hot day here in Music City. Temperatures are expected to get close to 100 for the whole weekend, and there is no rain in the forecast. Supplemental watering is going to be the order of the day for our vegetable garden. Thanks, as always, to Ron Trammell for our very cool intro music. It is well established that I'm a cheerleader for parks of all varieties, and I have a special fondness for city parks. Tennessee has some truly stellar local parks. On this podcast, we have, for example, featured the historic Warner Parks in Nashville on a couple of occasions. But there are several others worthy of note. Point Park in Lookout Mountain, Bays Mountain Park in Kingsport come to mind, along with Steel Creek Park in Bristol. These parks actually predate the establishment of the state park system and even the establishment of regular municipal park and recreation agencies across the state. On today's program, we're going to feature one such historic city park, Overton Park in Memphis. This is a 300-acre jewel right in Midtown Memphis. We will learn a bit about the history of the park and its remarkable old-growth forest preserve, as well as their plans for stewardship of the old forest section of the park. My guests today are Melissa McMasters and Eric Bridges of the Overton Park Conservancy. I had a great time talking with these two leaders and have a heartfelt sense that this resource is in good hands. And we will get started right after this brief message.
Hi, this is Heather Lose, Editor-in-Chief of the Tennessee Conservationist Magazine. Every year, we publish 6 beautiful issues packed full of timely and informative stories about Tennessee culture, people, and places. You can stay informed about your world and all the great things happening in your Tennessee state parks. It's easy to subscribe. Just go to our website at tnconservationist.org. Thank you.
Melissa McMasters and Eric Bridges, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Well, it's really terrific to have you guys on and to meet you both and to talk today about Overton Park in Memphis, Tennessee. Obviously, this is a park with a storied history, and we'll talk about that. And we'll talk about what's going on today and projects that are planned and intended. As we get started, I really do like to have my listeners learn a little bit about the people I'm talking with and what inspired them to get into this line of work and parks and conservation and that sort of thing. So, Melissa, can we start with you? Tell us about yourself and how you got into this park work.
Sure. I am a native Memphian, and I had not really had much of a nature background. I went to grad school in Pittsburgh for English, and I was looking for any kind of a communications job. And one of the ladies in my cooking club was leaving her job at the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy. And so she said it was a great place to work. And so I applied, got on there, and it just completely changed the trajectory of my life. So 5 years, I kind of got great nature immersion, wound up really falling in love with specifically dragonflies and damselflies through photography. And when I moved back to Memphis, that happened to be right around the time that Overton Park Conservancy was starting. So I wound up being the communications director there, and I have been here ever since, almost 12 years now.
Well, that's a great thing. Absolutely. You know, I'm not really familiar with the Pittsburgh parks. I've only visited there once in my life, and a beautiful city.
It's a great park system.
Yeah. That's something to be explored, certainly.
Indeed.
Eric, tell us about yourself.
Yeah, I think, so I am a forester. I think I grew up the normal forester route, just being outside. I think it was one of those don't come back in the house till it's dark kind of situations, but grew to love being in the woods, obviously hunting and fishing with family. But I knew when I went to college, I didn't know what to do, and I didn't do very well. But I knew two things. I knew I knew I loved being in the woods. My brain worked better when I was in the woods. And I knew I loved trigonometry. I don't know why, but it rang a bell with me. And at one point, I was trying to get my life together. I was in a Colorado Outward Bounds program, 30 days of backpacking in the Colorado Rockies. And I met some people from the US Forest Service, realized you could make a living being in the woods and using trigonometry as an inventory forester. Applied when I got
Oh my
back
goodness.
and stayed with the Forest Service for 7 years. Went back to Colorado State then and actually got a degree on the second time I tried it. So I have my bachelor's in forestry from state, Colorado State, that is. And then I went to, when we moved back to Memphis, I went to Mississippi State, got my master's degree, and I'm currently about a month away from getting my PhD in forestry from Mississippi State as well in forest ecology. So it's sort of stuck. And I've worked mostly as an inventory forester, but then when we moved back to Memphis, I realized I was going to have to embrace urban forestry, something I hadn't been exposed to. And I used to, say to my friends who are in urban forestry, I don't know how you do that with all those people. And then I realized it is hard. It's much harder than what I had been doing. So I was a city forester in a little town called Lakeland, which is just one of the suburban communities around Memphis. I did that for 12 years. And then this job came open with the Overton Park Conservancy. And so now I'm their operations director and I manage the Old Forest State Natural Area.
Great story. Eric, where exactly did you grow up?
Southern Indiana, Northern Kentucky, in that range.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I got that. Super. Urban forestry is a critical thing in these days and times, isn't it?
It is, and I heard you interview Gene Hyde, who was one of my mentors, and we called him Uncle Gene because he was an uncle to all of the urban foresters in Tennessee, and for somehow he made time for all of us and our questions and our growing pains because he really set the standard, not just in Tennessee, as you know, Chattanooga, Tennessee, and then pretty much the region and parts of the nation.
Yeah, Gene is an ally of mine from long standing. We worked together in the old Department of Conservation before it became the Conservation and Environment. And he actually was a grants administrator for the old Bureau of Outdoor Recreation grants and spent a lot of time in Memphis working grants to the city of Memphis and to the surrounding communities down there. So yeah, super dude.
You know, we
All right.
always say we have one of the things we're most proud of in Memphis is that it's famously the birthplace of Gene Hyde.
Well, I wouldn't have been able to guess that, but now that you say it, I kind of do remember that. Super. Let's talk about this, Melissa. Let's talk about this Overton Park. And it's been probably 30 years since I have actually visited Overton Park.
Got to get you back out here.
I need to get down there. Back in the day of the Memphis Park Commission, and I understand that's no longer an entity that's working, but this is a park in Midtown Memphis, and so take it from there and kind of give us the lay of the land for Overton Park.
Sure. Overton Park has actually been around since 1901 when it was the eastern outskirts of Memphis. That was back during the City Beautiful movement that Frederick Law Olmsted was kind of the father of, where the cities were rapidly industrializing and people needed a place to go and be outside and have a little break from what the pollution and everything else that was going on. So the Memphis Commission, which started around 1900, decided that they wanted a system of parks and parkways that surrounded the city. And the signature flagship park was going to be Overton Park. Of course, it didn't have that name at that time. But the city purchased this tract of land that was largely wooded from Overton and Ella Lee, who I know you said also donated some land in Nashville for Warner
Right. Their
Park.
family
So,
did. Yeah, their family did.
yeah. Yeah. So we have that kinship that way amongst our cities. So they purchased that land, and it was about 342 acres, 200 or so of which were wooded. That number today is more like 140 acres that are still wooded, because, of course, as parks grow, different amenities wind up springing up. So, the first few decades of Overton Park, you saw the formation of the Memphis Zoo. We had a nine-hole golf course that came online. The Brooks Museum of Art came online during that first decade. And then we had, a system of pavilions and bridle paths and a big open meadow. So it's really the park is kind of divided in half by Lick Creek, and you'll get these open areas to the left and then the old forest to the right. So that was kind of how it all came to be.
Right. The zoo is still operational there. The golf course still operational.
Yes.
And
And the
since the demise of the Memphis Park Commission, the city council, as I understand it, has just basically taken back to itself the authority to manage the parks, took it back from the Park Commission, and then in turn has made some sort of an arrangement with your nonprofit to manage the parts of the park which are not otherwise managed by the
Yeah,
golf
so
or
big
tell us
movement
more
around
about
the
that.
sure. Big movement around the country kind of in early 2000s. So Pittsburgh Parks was one of the earlier ones, I believe, to start with this public-private partnership model. We were finding across the country that parks were deteriorating because of disinvestment. So there became all this capital backlog and not as much maintenance. So they were not becoming really great places to visit. And a deteriorating park is just a big empty and all kinds of bad uses wind up coming in there. So we were created in 2011, Overton Park Conservancy. There was a movement via two city leaders, George Cates and Gary Shorb. They kind of started this from scratch, and they had volunteers deployed to go around the city and especially in the park and ask people what they wanted to see from the park. And it was, a lot of it was just basic cleanliness, safety, working restrooms, a place for dogs to run off leash that was fenced, and then protection of the old forest. So once we got these survey results, the city voted and they incorporated the conservancy, and we have been around operating since 2012. And concurrently along those lines with creation of the conservancy was to get the old forest 126 acres protected as a Tennessee State Natural Area, which we work to manage. Well, Eric specifically.
So is there like an operating agreement or a memorandum of understanding or what is there? Tell us, or a
Yes.
contractual relationship between you and the city council? Tell us about that.
Correct. We had a 10-year management agreement from 2012 to 2022 that we've renewed for another 10 years. So
Got it.
we work in
Got it.
partnership with the Memphis Parks organization, the city's organization, but largely we are the ones managing the day-to-day at the park.
So you're responsible for getting the garbage picked up, the grass cut, the whole situation.
All that good stuff.
Okay. Well, it's an interesting thing to talk about because certainly friends organizations, an idea is sweeping the nation. I mean, that's going on in the state parks and all in cities all over America. It's a step beyond that, though, for an organization to take on actual management of a park. Certainly can be done and is being done successfully. Especially a featured park like Overton Park is. So it's, the city of Memphis has several hundred parks. And I know that they have to mostly manage them on their own account. They can't have a friends organization for each one. But when you have a featured park like this, that's such a, it's the front lawn of the city of Memphis. It takes a group being focused on that.
Right. We have over 1.3 million visits per year. So those, a lot of those are coming to the cultural attractions, but a lot of them are also coming to enjoy the playgrounds or go for a run. So it's a lot of traffic that we have to keep up with. And we're really the welcome mat for all of those cultural organizations, in
Sure.
addition to being someplace that people will come on their own.
Sure. And then you guys, being a not-for-profit, I presume 501c3 status,
Yes.
are able to raise money to do the operational and the capital development aspects.
Yes, that is a big part of it. We get less than 15% of our budget from the city, and then we have to raise all the rest of it. So we've got
Wow.
corporate supporters and individual donors. So basically, anybody who's invested in the life of the park is always welcome to contribute. We value that very, very much.
And I presume that you all are doing programmatic sorts of activities in addition to just, you know, carrying the keys around.
Yes.
Tell us about the programs that your organization presents to the public.
Yeah, we actually just ramped that up last year. We've been doing kind of bits and bobs throughout the last decade, but last year we hired a programs manager, Dr. Maya Carrasco-Harris, and she's putting on dozens and dozens of programs a year. So we know that our number one focus is going to be on connecting people to the Old Forest and getting them involved in that nature, because folks in the city may not be able to travel to like a national park or and get that experience of being hands-on with nature, but we know we can give that to them right here. So we have walks, we have a series called Nature 101, where we have volunteers come out who are experts in fungi or birds or insects, and they just lead kind of basic walks that get people comfortable with it and kind of introduce them to all of the nature in our city.
Melissa,
that's just one.
Well, and I just think that those programs are just so important, and our state parks also have learned that it's not enough to just have a place there and just sort of wait for people to come.
Right.
You know, actually facilitating an experience that they might have when they come is so important. It adds a dimension to that visitor's experience, and it makes the whole thing work. This may be the time to talk a little bit with Eric about what's going on with the Old Forest. And Melissa, you may also interpose whatever you have to add about this, but it's curious that a city-owned park would be classified as a state natural area. Now, I sort of have an idea how that works, but one of you take that on and tell us how that works.
Yeah, if that's okay, I'll jump in, Melissa.
Please do.
Okay. Well, we have a few urban state natural areas in West Tennessee, and so of course, you know, Mark, they're managed by TDEC's Division of Natural Areas, led by Roger McCoy, and our stewardship ecologist Alan Trentley here. So we have Lucius Birch and Shelby Farms is a state natural area, and then we have, which is publicly owned but not by the state. And then we have Riverwoods and City of Germantown. Then we have the Old Forest State Natural Area, of course, that's here in Overton Park. So it is interesting, though. So the land is owned by the City of Memphis. We are the daily managers. And then the state oversees that management. And so essentially, you can, if we can zoom out just a tiny bit and look at sort of how these spaces exist and put them in some context. I think you were in parks administration in Gatlinburg.
Yes. Yeah,
many lives ago. And you know, in a lot of parks, there are some little natural areas, we would call them. So they're a bit wild. We don't mow. And children love them, right? They explore, they get to free play. And we call those urban forested natural areas. And so they're part of the urban forest, but they're a unique breed. And so when we think of the urban forest, we think a lot about people like Gene Hyde in Chattanooga, who have this street tree program, and they manage and maintain an inventory of the trees between the sidewalk and the curb that help calm traffic and protect pedestrians and provide us all those benefits. We also have a category in the urban forest that we call park trees, where, you know, we have picnic tables and mowed grass, and we love those, the shade around the playground, those critical functions. And those two types of places require a certain type of management and a certain level of investment. But then there's that third one, that urban forested natural area that I just mentioned, where they're a bit wild. And here's where it gets tricky, because we can't necessarily apply the same management techniques to those areas. We can't do individual tree care. We would call that arboriculture or arboriculture in urban forestry. And we can't quite apply that rural forestry model, what we would call silviculture. So if we were managing thousands of acres on a national forest or something. So they're in this in-between land, and they're very much at risk, as you know and have talked to people on this podcast before, because of all the invasive species and the impacts from the number of people. And so we need sort of we don't have a playbook for how to manage them. So that's where this Old Forest State Natural Area, we hope, we're using it as a model. We're going to try to build some best management practices in concert with TDEC and their stewardship ecologists, and try to take this out to the larger community and help people manage these spaces so that they keep providing all the benefits that we like from them. So it's tricky though, because it is urban and it is owned by the city. And there are 800,000 visitors to our Old Forest State Natural Area every year. And that's a lot of footprints.
Right. Fantastic. Just a stone's throw from my house is Radnor Lake, state natural area, state park, natural area, actually managed by the state. But I can remember in the early days of that park being opened, and this was a territory, policy territory that had been unexplored. How are we going to keep people from jumping in the water and swimming or going fishing and, doing all those things that they had been accustomed to doing previous to the state's ownership. It can be a challenge, especially when you have that many visitors.
Mark, that's right. And we look to people like Steve Ward and
exactly
at Radnor as leaders in this area. They're aggressive with their treatment of invasive species. And then moving beyond that, Mark, as you know, they team up with researchers like Dr. Robert Loeb, who you've had on, I believe, but helped me with my dissertation.
No kidding.
Actually, yep. He came to Memphis, walked the Old Forest with us, gave me some good ideas for research. My research was in the Old Forest State Natural Area.
I see.
So we look to them. Radnor is a great example of holistic management. So we like to look at it as, we like to say this, Mark, see if this makes any sense. We're moving away from the invasives removal business and we're moving toward the forest restoration business. So, and I think Dr. Loeb said this on, at least to me, he has many times, you pull that invasive species out, now you've got an open space, something's going to grow there. And if you're not on top of it, it's going to be the next invasive.
Well, that's right, and you have to have some thought about what would have grown there otherwise. I mean, I don't know if that's the way to put it, but nature abhors a vacuum.
Exactly.
and so, if you remove all the privet hedge and the honeysuckle, and just wait for something to happen, something will happen, but it may not be a desirable thing.
That's right. The other thing we really focus on, Mark, is the problem of oak recruitment. And you know, oaks are a foundational species in Tennessee, well, across the eastern United States forests. But what I mean by foundational for the listeners, it would be similar to, like, you probably heard of the concept of a keystone species or something in animals. So in plants, we would call it a foundational species. It's somewhat of an analogy, but it's a little different. But it's a species that has a real heavy impact on the ecology. And so oaks, as we know from Dr. Tallamy and people like that, are hosts to so many important insects, which start that ripple effect of birds and then predator birds. Anyway, it across the eastern United States, we're struggling to get our oaks to regenerate. And when I say recruitment, I mean add a new individual to the population.
Okay.
And there's a lot of discussion in rural forestry about, the changes in the fire regimes, because oaks are really are real fire tolerant species and they do well. And we've changed that fire regime, obviously, as we've moved in closer to these areas. There's obviously white-tailed deer, maybe overpopulation can have a high impact on oak populations.
Sure. They eat a lot of acorns, those deer.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
But what we haven't really studied is oaks in these urban forested natural areas. So we have data that shows, oaks are our dominant overstory species by far. Our dominant overstory species, but they're just almost completely absent from the seedling and sapling layer. And that's not an uncommon situation in forests. But what's unique is that we don't have white-tailed deer, and we haven't for many, many decades.
I wondered, Okay.
And we are a forest that probably didn't burn a bunch. I mean, I think it probably burned some when the Chickasaw Nation occupied the site. But so that's a really critical thing. So tying that in with the invasive species, nature does abhor that vacuum. If we can somehow work that into the ecology of oaks, we would like to think we can maybe start to develop the next generation of oaks and not lose them from this landscape. And then maybe that's a model we can take out to others.
Let me drop back and retrench just maybe a little bit and have you, if you could, Eric, describe the forest there.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
And what would the visitor see? And I will say this as I ask that question. Yesterday, in preparing for this, I found a 50-minute video on YouTube of a walk through this of the forest. I don't know if you all were involved with producing that. I know your executive director, is it Miss
Tina
Sullivan?
Sullivan.
Miss Sullivan, I think was in this video, and led a group around there, and somebody took a video of it. But
Yeah.
if the listener wants to see such a thing, just search for Overton Park Old Forest and under videos in Google, and it will pop up, that YouTube video. And it's an impressive thing to go through. It's a leafy place. But tell us in more detail, and big trees, clearly. But tell us in more detail what would the visitors see if they went through there?
Yeah, that's a good point, Mark. And Melissa will chime in with some of the other wildlife. So I focus on the trees, right? And I would say, not to get too academic, but it's what's called a mixed mesophytic forest. And what that means is it's not dry and it's not overly wet. It's the perfect place for a wide variety of species. So when you walk in, the first thing that hits you in the face are little groves of tulip poplar that are 6 feet in diameter, 165 feet tall. I've only seen tulip poplar like that in the coves of the Smoky
In the Great
Mountains,
Smokies, yes,
right?
exactly.
Maybe the Joyce Kilmer Grove or something. And it's the only place that I've seen them on this part of the state, though. And so we have this super deep, rich soil and great moisture, and they grow very well. And then you'd see the oaks, the Shumard oaks and the cherry bark oaks. And we have 11 species of oaks in the Old Forest, but again, same size, giant trees, really staggering how tall they get. We have a measure in forestry we call site index, which is how tall a tree can grow with the soil you have in 50 years. Our site index is about 130, which means in 50 years, those trees can be 130 feet tall, which is astounding. For a forester, it's amazing. I've never worked in a place like this. I've never had the
Yeah, it's
opportunity to work in such
10 stories high. I mean,
in 50
that's a big
years.
tree.
So about 60 species of trees, and then maybe over 300 probably vascular plant species. Melissa, am I close?
Something like that. I think when we had a floristic study conducted in 2009, we had almost 350 species in total,
Including the trees.
including the trees.
Right, that makes sense. And then the other thing, Mark, that people would probably be, I think, would strike them is the pawpaw. So pawpaw is our native understory tree. You know it well. We love it. I have never seen so many pawpaw in my life. We have them, multiple thousands of pawpaw per acre in the Old Forest. Thousands, up to, in some places, 5 or 6 thousand pawpaw per acre. I've never seen that before. It's astounding
Wow.
how thick they
Wow.
are. And they produce fruit.
That's kind of amazing, because I would associate pawpaw with a wetter circumstance.
Yeah, we've always, in my career, 32 years of this, they were limited to little pockets, wet areas. Yeah, you would find patches, I guess, and groves of pawpaw, but I've never seen them just uniformly spread across the landscape like this.
And tell us, what is the status as far as invasive exotics and their presence on the property?
Yeah, so for the listener, they probably understand this concept, but when we say invasive, we're just meaning a plant that didn't evolve in this area, and so is not providing the same benefits as a native plant, and for various reasons will spread and take up the growing space that native plants would have. Native, we mean plants that have evolved at least since the last ice age in this area. And so our invasive plants are robust, healthy, doing well. We are making some progress, but in the tree layer we have 7 invasive trees. So we have the common, I think, ones you would have known, Tree of Heaven, Ailanthus. We have Paulownia, or the Princess Tree. And then we have mimosa, all that stuff that people put in their yards. So in that urban area, of course, as you can imagine, we like to call it the problem of proximity to propagules. We're just too close to everything, and the birds bring the seeds in, and the wind brings the
Sure,
seeds in.
sure.
But we're working pretty good on those. The other problem area with invasives for us is the vines. So kudzu is there. We keep it in check, but it's pretty hard to eradicate. You can just keep after it. And then, of course, English ivy and wisteria and the winter creeper. What am I missing there?
Honeysuckle.
Lots of honeysuckle, both bush and vine. So yeah, it's been a constant battle, but we have this, what I think is interesting. We have a species we're considering an invasive, but it's native to the southeast. And so this is a concept that's become a point of discussion among managers of these urban forested natural areas. It didn't evolve here. And so, taking a plant from, this is called cherry laurel, Prunus
Oh, sure. Yeah,
caroliniana.
I know cherry laurel.
Very, very popular in the landscape, from deep South Carolinas. You wouldn't expect a plant from Florida to, serve the same function in Tennessee as it. Anyway, it's the basically the same effect as if you would have brought it across a continent. And so we're working on that one, and it's sort of tricky because people like that plant and they associate it with their yard.
I made the mistake of purchasing one of those and planting it in my yard years ago. Now I cut it down, but it's still coming up all around the yard.
Wow, that's right.
So absolutely, that's a fascinating thing. Now you're managing the invasives. How exactly? What is
Yeah.
your approach?
Yeah, so the first thing we did, of course, was we had called Roger McCoy and got his team down here, and we even got the Nature Tennessee of Tennessee, the Nature Conservancy of Tennessee, sorry, and we all kind of got together and said, what's our best approach? Because I think I don't think I was overwhelmed. I didn't know where to start. What's the priority? And so that was really helpful talking to those ecologists. They kept telling me, resist the urge to curl up in a ball and give up. But so we took sort of the what we would call maybe an integrated pest management approach, which means we just tried all the tools, we tried to put as many tools in our toolbox as possible. And so that's where you would we use mechanical methods, where we uproot things or cut. And we can talk some about the specifics. We use chemical methods, so the herbicides. We use cultural methods, which is what we would call meaning education, like please stop planting this.
Yes.
And then letting us know when you do see it in the forest. And we haven't adopted sort of a biological approach. We're probably never going to release bugs or something into the forest that eat a particular invasive, but multiple tools. And then the other way we sort of tried to look at it was, are we going to take sort of an extensive or an intensive approach? And we decided that we had to do both a little bit. And but what I mean by that is, do we cover the whole forest and get as much as we can? But by the time you finish, you're kind of coming back to the starting point and it's grown back, maybe some of the things you've been working on. Or do we like pick a spot and we just get all the invasives in that spot as hard as we can? And we did a little of both. And so things like kudzu, you can't ignore. So we had that has to be addressed extensively everywhere you see it. So those species we worked on extensively, and then we did pick some areas where we had canopy gaps where trees had fallen and the invasives had moved in, where they would have been sunlight feeding oaks and tulip poplar, it was feeding
You
invasives.
bet.
Yeah. So then
And
we
are you
would.
using volunteer crews or
Yeah,
drone crews or tell
that's
us
what I forgot to
contractors
mention.
or
Yeah. So a little of all of that, but the primary method is volunteers. And when we look and you look at it, like, and you know this, Mark, you can't do it all. You can't staff up to that level. It isn't possible. So training volunteers and getting them engaged, and that's mostly with the mechanical work and having tools like uprooters. And then, but also there are eyes, training them to identify invasives so we can get there quickly before they get too much of a handle. And then we do have hire contractors periodically. There's a company out of Nashville that we use,
Sure.
Invasive Plant Control Incorporated.
Right.
But it's really been great because when you get a volunteer engaged, then they start to take some ownership of that space. They've worked on that patch and they go back and check it, and they're not going to let that tree of heaven come back, right? That's their spot. And then we've been exploring a little bit with getting some of our volunteers certified as pesticide applicators so we can do some low-level herbicide applications. We try not to do the broadcast spraying where we don't have to. We do some basal bark painting where we just paint the stump. and let it absorb in through the bark so you don't get that overspray and that non-target kill.
So the Old Forest part of Overton Park consists of about 125, 130 acres, something like that. And are
It's
there
a yeah.
existing trails that users can use to access these areas, I presume. Tell us about those.
Sure. We have an extensive trail system. It's about 10 miles in total. There's a limestone running loop. There's a paved trail where kids can kind of learn to ride bikes. And then we've got the primitive trails, so the dirt trails that go through the 126 acres. And we will have another one of those primitive trails that comes online in the 16 acres that is about to be added back to the forest.
Well, and that was the point of me starting into that line of inquiry. So you haven't let's talk about that project that you've got grant approval for. And I guess I noticed at one point on your Facebook feed some announcement about this, and my buddy Bob Richards being involved with the layout of the new trails. And so tell us about this new project. I presume am I correct that it's involving a piece of land that up to now has been part of the zoo's operational area behind their fence, so to speak. And that's going to become a part of the Old Forest to be managed by you all. Tell us about that story. What's going on?
Sure. Yeah, this is a great thing. How often do you get to add acreage back into a
There it
park? So
is.
we're
Absolutely.
very excited about that. This is it's part of a big, long, complicated puzzle of a story, but that piece of land, those 16 acres, were fenced in the 1980s as part of the zoo's master plan, and they were hoping to create an exhibit about forest ecology in Memphis. It just never got off the ground, so it's just kind of been sitting back there. And as we have evolved as an organization, we've developed all these invasive management plans, and we've got this opportunity to add our sort of our management plan to this new acreage. So how it came about that it's coming back into the park is another thing that was happening since the 80s is that the zoo has gotten so popular, and on really busy days, they were parking overflow cars on the park's greensward. So about a third of that big open space in the center of the park on really beautiful days, we had a lot of conflict between the zoo parking, and then also that's the day that everybody wants to come to the park and just play their games and walk and just relax. So it's been a big civic conflict off and on for about 30 years. And over the last 10 years of the Conservancy's existence, we've been working with the zoo and with the city to solve that. But it's very hard to find new land to accommodate all these uses. But lucky for all of us, the city had some acreage at the southeast corner of the park that has been used as a vehicle maintenance facility for about 100 years. And the city has found some better places to go. So they have vacated that. So we've got about 12 acres down there
Oh
that
my, that's a
are kind
large
of,
place.
yeah, up for grabs. So initially, we at the Conservancy were going to get that whole space, and we were looking at how to use that as part of just park amenities. But what we wound up deciding altogether is that the zoo would use kind of the north part of that site, about a third of it, and move their maintenance facility down there. The buildings are already in place, so the uses are compatible. They're not going to have to do a whole lot of construction. So they are in the process of getting that done, and the Conservancy will identify how to use the southern part of that space. But once the zoo frees up that land on their site, they can put a parking lot in there. We won't have to use the greensward for parking anymore. And just as part of the package, since the Conservancy did not get all of the land that we were expecting to get in that swap, the zoo very graciously told us that we could have that forested land back. So we are going to add that to our managed area officially and apply to have that added to the state natural area and begin managing it in the same way that we manage the rest of the forest.
So tell me, what is the status of this project today? When is the fence going to be moved? When is the boundary going to be changed? When are we going to start removing invasives there? All those things. Tell us, what's the timeline on all that?
Yeah, well, we've received amongst the zoo, the city, and the conservancy a $3 million grant from the Department of Housing and Urban Development, which was secured by our congressman, Steve Cohen. And that money, as soon as we get a notice to proceed from HUD, we can get going with the trail construction. As you mentioned, Bob Richards actually has designed the trail. So he really went in there and took a look at the site and tried to deal with the natural topography so that we can appreciate kind of the rolling way that it works. And Eric, you can talk a little bit more about the unique ecology of that site versus the rest.
Yeah, so Mark, you know Bob well, and he's a friend of ours. He's been a part of Overton Park Conservancy since the beginning, and you know he's trained as a forester.
Oh,
So
I do know that. Yes,
yeah, so
yes.
we have some robust conversations out there. It's a lot of fun to work with Bob. So he was able to identify, like I mentioned, we have 56 tree species. I'm not sure if I mentioned that, but we have that mixed mesophytic forest. So you just get this great opportunity. We call it the gumbo, to have a sycamore tree, right, that you would associate with a swampy area, and you turn around and there is a post oak or a white oak that you would associate with a high dry area, and they're just intermingled. It is really fun. And so he was able to identify some of these unique specimens, like these giant sycamores that are going to be such a highlight in the winter, well, all year, but especially when the sunlight hits their bark in the winter. And as you know, in West Tennessee is pretty flat. So when we do get a little topography, a lot of things change pretty quickly, different plant species. And so Bob kind of was able to hug some of those topographic features. As small as they are to us, they're sort of a Smoky Mountain, they're Clingman's Dome for us. So Bob was able to point out those areas where we can have interpretation, have opportunities to stop and talk with people. And then he even identified like some great fallen logs where we're going to look at, the animal poop on the logs, and just all those great ways to engage the kids. So yeah, he was very instrumental. He knows what we are trying to do, and he's been doing it for so long. Our motto was sort of like, let's open the gate and then get out of Bob's way. But he also knows that if, and you know this too, Mark, if we don't identify these trails now, before we take that fence down, we're gonna have trails, and they may not be where we like them. So.
Exactly. I should say this is kind of old home week. We've talked about Gene Hyde, who was the city forester for the city of Chattanooga for many years, and my former colleague at the Conservation Department, and a guest on this program in the past. And Bob Richards was the actually the very first guest of mine on the Mark Fraley podcast when we are on episode number one back in 2017. So
Nice.
I'm thrilled that he's involved there, and I really can't, it's hard for me to grasp how Bob does it all, how he gets around Tennessee the way he does, and maintains contact with so many of his friends throughout the state. It's a credit to him. Trail wise, what are the thoughts about surfacing of these trails, the new trails that are going to be put in?
Yeah, we're pretty lucky that our soils stay pretty put. I know they can be pretty loose in other areas, and we don't have the topography that carries the water that makes them erode. So at this time, we're gonna give it a whirl at natural surface. We'll see how that works. And Bob, of course, is an expert on getting the drainage right, which is the key, so that you don't start to develop erosion problems. But it will always be if we do end up coming in to do anything, it would be somewhat natural. We've got a situation in the existing Old Forest State Natural Area that's, I believe, unique in that there were bridle paths through the forest a long time ago, and so they were already really beat down and compacted. And that's where our trails, we just put them there, and they had bridges, WPA era stone culverts, right? That they're so, I think they're beautiful, but people, will say they were just finding rocks, left over. And so we had that. We don't have that here. So we're going to try to at least mimic some of that sort of style so it looks consistent. And then obviously have, entry and exit points that make sense with the existing trail system. But surfacing wise, yeah, I think we'll be pretty It'll be pretty easier for us than a lot of people, and that we have that good solid soil and it compacts very quickly and doesn't wash. The other part of this, Mark, I don't mean to jump ahead, but I forgot to mention the HUD grant has gotten us to the point where we could have Bob design the trail, but also we hired a company, the one I mentioned, Invasive Plant Control Incorporated, to survey the site for the invasives and develop a plan of attack. And we sort of had the idea, if we can and we have the money, let's put a contractor in there and get a head start on this.
Oh, absolutely.
And then the volunteers can come in and maintain
Right.
sort of that level that they get us to. But that first step is really difficult. As you know, it's overwhelming.
Well, it can be, absolutely. And you know, when you're opening a new project like that, you want the first impression that the public has to be a nice impression, right? Of a place that's kind of orderly and not overly degraded by these invasives and that sort of thing. If you don't want, it's no fun to go to some place and look at kudzu.
You can drive down Mississippi, any Mississippi
It,
highway, right?
exactly. I have to say about our Nashville greenways. We have a lot of greenways in Nashville, most of which, I shouldn't say most of which, some are tunnels with honeysuckle bushes on both sides, and you really can't even see into the forest.
Right,
And
right.
so that's a challenge for our Nashville folks, but you don't want that to be the first impression of someone coming into a new project like that.
Right. And another aspect I think is very cool is that we've partnered with the Tennessee Division of Forestry to acquire some white oak seedlings and some other grant funding to help us implement some replanting efforts, like we talked about, moving from removal to restoration. So following behind, Invasive Plant Control Incorporated, we can come through with volunteers and dibble bars and hundreds of oak seedlings. And they're invested too. I mean, the Division of Forestry is been great partners for all of this. So I think it's just such a great opportunity, and it's generated all of this good energy around the old forest itself, but also trails and recreation for Overton Park.
Fantastic. And I would encourage listeners to get onto the social media pages of the Overton Park Conservancy. I know you're on Facebook. I don't know whether you what else you dabble in.
Yeah, we're on Facebook and Instagram at Overton
Instagram.
Park.
Okay, very good. Okay. Let me ask this just 'cause just it occurs to me to ask, do you have any grassland type areas there in Overton Park or in this new area or the old area?
Yeah, that is not a system that we have, and we often wonder about it. We know Duane Estes and those guys in the Grasslands Initiative, and we know it's a big part of the ecosystems of Tennessee, and I would imagine certainly West Tennessee included. In this area, we just haven't found evidence. In some forested areas, you can see that some evidence that there probably was previously grassland. We don't see any remnants of the species that would indicate grassland. And our trees, when we core them, I think you know what that is, but we'll core a little sample and count the tree rings when we can get a good sample. Some of them are dating back 240 years or so. So, like the
Wow.
1780s.
Wow.
That doesn't mean there wouldn't have been like a savanna style, open forest
There
that
you
may
go.
very well
Yeah,
have
there you
been.
go.
Some
Right.
of our species would suggest that it might have been quite a bit more open, and definitely not as many pawpaw. You can imagine the Chickasaw probably would have burned enough to keep the pawpaw in check as a thin-barked species that would have succumbed to the fire. But we don't have any evidence of actual open grasslands,
Right.
but maybe some
Yeah, but
savanna.
you know, but the savanna type grassland is something that people don't really think about as being a grassland because there are lots of trees. Okay, very fascinating. So fascinating. I would encourage listeners to check out the website of the Overton Park Conservancy because it's got a lot of great information, maps and activity, calendars of activities and all kinds of things like that. Melissa, tell us what they'll find there.
Sure. On our website or on our social channels, we have a lot of information about the park. We also, well, I also write a little series called Nature Zen that I put out every month. So if you are interested in silliness or heartfelt love of nature, it's different every month. So it really aims to introduce folks to the ecology of the park and other areas around Memphis and kind of connect you with that. And so we also, of course, will have tons of information about programming. We're gearing up for another big fall, lots of nature and art related programming in the park as well.
Super. Well, I just have to thank you both for joining me today. Give you an opportunity to chime in with any last remark that you might have, would like to have said and didn't get a chance to say.
I'll do first, and then Melissa, okay. You can. I would just I echo you, Mark, that we really hope people will come to the Old Forest. I mentioned there were 800,000 visitors to the Old Forest a year, and I didn't mean that to suggest we don't want you there. We want you to come and experience this space, but do stay on the trail.
Very good, very good. Well, and you guys, thank you so very much for spending your time with me today. It's been a joy to get to know you. And I hope that my listeners will reach out and learn more about what's going on in Overton Park.
Great. Thanks, guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark.